Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ralph Nader, America's leading public interest lawyer and four-time independent presidential candidate, who assesses the Democratic presidential primary campaign and addresses the concern expressed by some corporate Democrats about a Bernie Sanders nomination. Dr. Carla Tate, a member of the Wet'suwet'en Nation in British Columbia, Canada, who talks about the legal and political struggle to stop construction of the Coastal GasLink pipeline from traversing native land. And Margaret Poydock of the Economic Policy Institute, who discusses the recent House passage of the Protecting the Right to Organize Act and the links between the decline in union membership and rising inequality in the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As Syria's nine-year-long civil war drags on, Syrian government troops entered the strategic town of Sarakab, the country's last rebel stronghold, on February 6th, after fierce clashes with opposition fighters as Turkey deployed reinforcements seeking to halt the offensive. Sarakab, on the Turkish border, is located at the intersection of two major highways, one linking the capital Damascus to the north and another connecting the country's west and east. The push by President Bashar al-Assad's forces into towns and villages in the northwestern Idlib province has triggered the displacement of more than 500,000 people in just over 2 months, compounding a humanitarian disaster in the region flooded by internally displaced people. The battle has angered Turkey and risked a military confrontation between Turkey and Russian-backed Syrian troops. According to the World Health Organization, at least 53 hospitals and health clinics have shut down in the area due to the fighting. With an estimated 300 civilians killed in the fighting since mid-December, the EU has called for a ceasefire and urged warring factions to allow humanitarian aid workers and supplies into the area. Human Rights Watch reports that more than 200 immigrants and asylum seekers who the Trump regime deported back to El Salvador were killed or tortured. The Rights Monitor tracked 138 Salvadorians who were killed by gang members, police, soldiers, death squads, or ex-partners between 2013 to 2019. Most were killed within 2 years of being deported by the same perpetrators who they had tried to escape from in seeking refuge in the United States. El Salvador, with 6 million people, is one of the most violent nations in the world today, with high rates of homicide and sexual violence. According to The Guardian, 11,000 people were registered as missing over the last decade, higher than the number of people who disappeared during the Central American nation's civil war from 1979 to 1992. Much of the current violence is blamed on street gangs, most of which got their start in the U.S. Currently, international law prohibits the U.S. from returning anyone to a country where they face serious risk to their lives. Three-quarters of the 1.2 million Salvadorians living in the U.S. lack documentation or have temporary visas, making them vulnerable to Trump administration deportation orders. Between 2014 and 2018, the U.S. deported 111,000 Salvadorians and granted asylum to just 18% of applicants, the lowest rate in the region. Far away from expensive high-tech boom towns in California, New York, or Boston, Minneapolis is now the scene of what may be the nation's most ambitious urban experiment in working to address the crisis in a nationwide shortage of affordable housing. The city has launched an initiative that ends single-family zoning, which has long reserved large sections of the city, like others around the United States, for detached one-family homes. To promote affordable housing, the city is now encouraging the conversion of single-family homes to multifamily dwellings. The city's 2040 agenda creates new protections for renters and places new demands on developers. The Christian Science Monitor reports that new post-boomer communities are rooted in ideals of inclusiveness and diversity, across racial lines, among renters and owners, in varied styles of housing units for multi-generational families or cooperative ownership models. Other states are watching to see if Minneapolis's new housing initiative succeeds. For many Americans, middle-class lifestyles have grown harder to sustain as costs of college, healthcare, and housing have risen faster than paychecks. According to the Christian Science Monitor, half of all renters now spend more than 30% of their income on housing. With urban land values rising, these forces transcend any one generation. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
After the U.S. Senate impeachment trial, which acquitted Donald Trump without the benefit of documents or witnesses, the nation's attention has now turned to the volatile Democratic Party presidential primary campaign. In the Iowa caucuses, where tabulating candidate votes was a chaotic affair, two candidates emerged in a virtual tie: independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. One-time frontrunner, former Vice President Joe Biden lagged in fourth place after Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Going into the nation's first primary election in New Hampshire, the leading candidates were engaged in a pitched battle between Sanders and Warren in the progressive camp and Buttigieg, Biden, and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar of the party's moderate wing. National polls on the eve of the New Hampshire primary found Sanders in the lead, followed by Biden, Buttigieg, Warren, and billionaire former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Some press reports maintain that establishment Democrats are in panic mode, fearing that should self-declared Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders win their party's nomination, he'd lose badly to Trump, who signaled that he'd red-bait the Vermont senator at every turn, backed by hundreds of millions of dollars in corporate cash. Your reporter spoke with Ralph Nader, America's leading public interest lawyer and consumer advocate. Ralph, a four-time independent presidential candidate, is author, along with Mark Green, of the new book titled Fake President: Decoding Trump's Gaslighting, Corruption, and General BS. Here, Nader assesses the Democratic primary candidates and addresses the concerns some corporate Democrats have expressed about a Bernie Sanders nomination.
The Republicans never win, Scott. It's the Democrats who lose. They've been losing and losing, other than 2018. Nancy Pelosi's cautious approach has lost her four out of the last five congressional races, starting in 2010. They're always playing catch-up with the Republicans. Republicans beat him to the punch on gerrymandering. They beat him to the punch in so many areas. Lying, they get away with lying. They support programs supported by a minority of the people, and they still win. They're not up to the shenanigans, the brute determination of the Republicans, illustrated by the liar-in-chief, Donald Trump, the relentless, savage, sexual predator, the bigot, the racist, and he follows it up with programs, of course. He can't even face up to helping little kids in the country. Takes away food stamps, takes away nutritious school lunches, replaces them with junk food. That's the problem. We know what the Republicans are. They're the worst Republicans in history since 1854. It would appall Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, Senator Robert Taft. It's the Democrats that are allowing all this to happen. So the Democrats refuse to look at themselves in the mirror. And the big struggle now that's going on between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on the progressive side, and the extremist corporate Democrats, they are the extremists supporting all the positions that are not supported by a majority of the people. They are determined to crush Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and come up with Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden or even the former mayor of New York, anybody but progressive. That's the struggle going on inside the Democratic National Committee in Washington. and the fooling around already in Iowa, and they're going to count votes in Nevada in casinos. That's a nice place to count votes. They actually have voting precincts in casinos, and that's what did in Bernie. So that's just part of what's going on here. It's really a very titanic struggle between the forces of progressivism, which also get a lot of left-right support, like for a living wage, left-right support, universal health insurance, left-right support, cracking down on corporate crime, breaking up the big banks, living wage, et cetera. That's what the struggle is. And if they lose to Trump, the worst candidate, I mean, you can't imagine, even for evangelicals, he violates habitually 7 out of the 10 commandments. If they lose to Trump, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a new move for a major third party starting up, just like the Republicans emerged in the 1850s to replace the Whigs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask you about the New Hampshire primary, and what's more important is the clearly pitched battle we have going on now for the soul of the Democratic Party between the party's progressive wing and centrist corporate Democrats, as you said before, Ralph, between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and Mike Bloomberg, Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar. Where do you think this fight is headed? It's important because people around the country believe this election in November, if it goes the way of a second Trump term, is an existential threat to democracy itself.
I think that the best ticket is either a Sanders-Warren or Warren-Sanders ticket. And I think they're going to have to seriously consider combining their delegates at the Democratic National Convention. The attack on Sanders is going to be a Democratic socialist. You know, look, do you want him? And it's so easy to rebut that. I mean, you start out with, how about the corporate socialist? You can't diselect them. They own Washington, and Washington bails out Wall Street. And look what they've done to you. You think they've delivered for you, working people of America? You got the lowest wages in the Western world. You got the fewest solid pensions in the Western world. You don't have paid maternity leave for everyone. You don't have full insurance for everyone. You don't have paid sick leave. You don't have paid daycare. Why does Western Europe have all these? Why don't we have? Because the Republican Party is a corporate state party, and they know how to fight. The Democrats have got to learn how to fight, and that's what Bernie and Elizabeth are trying to do.
That was Ralph Nader, America's leading public interest lawyer and consumer advocate. Ralph is the author, along with Mark Green, of the new book titled Fake President: Decoding Trump's Gaslighting, Corruption, and General BS. Find more analysis and commentary on the Democratic presidential primary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Another anti-pipeline battle has been underway between indigenous people and a frack gas company. And just as in the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota in 2016, the government has weighed in on the side of the frackers. The Wet'suwet'en Nation of about 3,500 members is located on more than 13,000 square miles of land in the northwestern central interior of British Columbia, Canada. On New Year's Eve 2019, the government of British Columbia granted a temporary injunction to Coastal GasLink Pipeline LTD, a subsidiary of TC Energy, formerly TransCanada, preventing the Wet'suwet'en from interfering with pre-construction activities in building its 416-mile natural gas pipeline from west of Dawson Creek, British Columbia, to a liquefied natural gas export facility on the Pacific coast. A portion of that pipeline would traverse unceded Wet'suwet'en lands. And on January 5th, the hereditary chiefs of all five clans unanimously evicted Coastal GasLink from their territory. Even though British Columbia, on paper, has the strongest laws recognizing Indigenous sovereignty, the government sent 100 heavily armed Royal Canadian Mounted Police into the territory and arrested six matriarchs who were praying to the ancestors and for the thousands of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Charges were later dropped, but the standoff continues. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dr. Carla Tate, a member of the Wet'suwet'en Nation and the niece of Frida Husson, who founded a healing center in that area that predates the fight against the pipeline. Here, Tate describes recent developments in the fight and the help they're seeking from supporters.
The newer camps, the watch camps, where the arrests happened at the 39-kilometer mark, those were just established this year as a means to provide warm shelter for anyone who wanted to observe and hold accountable police in their enforcement of the injunction, because a lot of their conduct has shown overbroad enforcement of the injunction. They've established, for example, an exclusion zone, which they call the checkpoint, well in advance of them formally announcing enforcement. I think it was at the 27.5-kilometer mark. They were arbitrarily denying access to even some of our hereditary chiefs and most of our Wet'suwet'en members who were trying to come up and visit either Unist'ot'en or Gidimt'en, trying to bring in supplies, media, people who were trying to come in and document the happenings up here. So there was a lot of restriction on movement. And so that's why, in response, the observation area at 39, kind of a watch camp, was established, not to restrict access of CGL, it was, or violate the injunction in any way. It was more of a measure to ensure accountability and a means for people to come out and be on our territory and hold supplies for both the camp and then the Unist'ot'en Healing Village to ensure that, you know, we had some of the basic necessities we'd require.
Dr. Carla Tate, can you explain the role of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the RCMP, in this situation?
So after the interim injunction last year was awarded, the RCMP had decided to set up a remote station on our unceded territory within Gidimt'en boundaries. So at the 27-kilometer mark, they established a station for their RCMP officers who would then remain out there and come and patrol and follow us during traditional activities such as medicine or berry gathering, any trapping. They would come and surveil us and then respond to any complaints by the CGL company when we attempted to access our territories for cultural uses. The RCMP stated that the purpose of that temporary station, that unwelcome temporary station, because they've been asked several times by our chiefs to remove it, the RCMP stated that it was for the safety of our members as well as the CGL workers. Of course, there's been a number of incidences that jeopardize the safety of guests of ours who were trying to monitor the access of the CGL workers during their pre-construction work while we are awaiting the court date for the permanent injunction decision. But the RCMP had never responded or investigated any of our complaints regarding unsafe behavior by the Coastal GasLink employees or their contractors. So our chief demanded that they remove the station, which is not in place for our interests or our safety, and had asked that they remove the exclusion zone they'd set up a number of weeks ago at that 27.5-kilometer mark, where they were arbitrarily denying the press and Wet'suwet'en membership access to the territory and limiting the movement of essential supplies. The RCMP refused to do either of those things, and the only talks that the provincial government agreed to were basically a meeting with the Minister of Aboriginal Relations and Reconciliation, who has no power or authority to address the issue at hand, namely the discussion about free prior informed consent for this Coastal GasLink pipeline project. So there was no nation-to-nation talks carried forth in good faith in this past week, and at the end of the week, the RCMP said that they would enforce the injunction, which meant that they would enter our territories and remove our members from our land if we violated the injunction or limited CGL's access. Canada's putting the onus on us, a small nation, established well before Canada, to prove in their court system, under their law, that we own these lands, that we have title to these lands. So I'm sure you can imagine facing that kind of huge, endlessly resourced entity that is Canada, we've hardly been in a position to challenge and establish our title through their legal system. So donations to the legal fund will help, especially since we're planning to stand our ground here.
That was Dr. Carla Tate, a member of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. Learn more about the continuing struggle to stop the Coastal GasLink pipeline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the nation focused on the aftermath of the Senate impeachment trial acquittal of Donald Trump and the first contest in the Democratic presidential primary campaign in Iowa and New Hampshire, the House of Representatives won passage of a landmark bill for U.S. workers. By a vote of 224 to 194, the House passed the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or PRO Act. The PRO Act, H.R. 2474, would remove many existing obstacles in the workplace, standing in the way of workers who want to form and join labor unions. The legislation would also make it easier for unions to negotiate with employers to win contracts and impose penalties on companies that violate workers' rights to organize in collective bargaining. In 1983, unions represented 20% of the U.S. workforce. Today, membership has been cut in half to just 10%. As union membership has declined in recent decades, economic inequality in the U.S. has risen to its highest level in 50 years. Your reporter spoke with Margaret Poydock, policy associate with the Economic Policy Institute, who assesses the importance of the House passage of the PRO Act and the links between union representation and the economic health of America's working families.
So the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or I'm going to call it the PRO Act because that's what it's informally called, is a legislation that would strengthen workers' rights to organize and collectively bargain. There are many provisions in this bill since it's been nearly 80 years since the last time federal labor law was changed. And while there are many provisions, I feel like there are a few that are important to highlight. The first is strengthening the right to strike by banning permanent replacements and allowing secondary strikes. Another important provision is establishing a process to reach a first contract so employers don't stall the collective bargaining process. And finally, which I think is the most important provision, is it enacts meaningful monetary penalties against employers that violate workers' rights under the National Labor Relations Act. I think this is the most important one because currently there are no monetary penalties for when an employer violates labor law. At most, an employer can receive a cease and desist order, or they can be ordered to post a notice saying that they have broken the law. But under the PRO Act, an employer can receive penalties up to $50,000 for each violation of a worker's rights. And I think that adding monetary penalties actually creates real teeth for the National Labor Relations Act that it currently doesn't have. This is shown by a recent report that EPI actually did that found that more than 40% of employers were charged with violating workers' rights during the election process in 2016, 2017.
Thank you for that, Margaret. Would you comment for us on the erosion of labor rights over these past several decades? What's been the primary source of the erosion of workers' ability to organize themselves into labor unions and fight for fair wages and benefits?
I would say there are a variety of things, but the main reason would probably be corporate interests that have been lobbying state politicians to enact right-to-work laws that weaken unions, banning fair share fees, the fee that, the dues that pay for the ability for the union to collectively bargain on behalf of its union members. Under right-to-work states, union members, legally, they do not have to pay these fair share fees, despite the fact that these unions are doing these great things for them by collectively bargaining and fighting, administering those bargaining agreements.
One of the big questions here, Margaret, is the link between union membership across the country and rising inequality. And certainly one of the main reasons that so many people in the House of Representatives got behind the PRO Act. But maybe you could draw out those links for our listeners on the connection between labor union membership and a paycheck that keeps up with inflation and provides a steady, livable income for working families across the country. I'd like to get your take on a little bit of the history of that and the economics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like for the last few decades, we've seen corporate influence on politicians, which has led to the rolling back of workers' rights in favor of business interests. And this has made it harder for people to join unions. And like you said, has caused working people's wages to stagnate and ultimately increased income inequality. And the reason for that is like you said, when unions are strong, they set wage standards for entire industries and occupations. They make wages more equal within occupations, and they help close racial and gender wage gaps. So the simple way to put it is when there are strong unions, the less income inequality there is.
Margaret, as we wind down here, I wanted to ask you, the conventional wisdom is that, number one, the Senate probably won't take this up. And if it did, it would probably lose in the Republican-controlled Senate. And even if it managed to get through, that Donald Trump has threatened to veto the bill. And you'd need two-thirds mm-hmm. vote in each the House and Senate to override that veto. So it doesn't look mm-hmm. likely that this is going to come into force anytime soon. But maybe you could speak to the importance of this bill, notwithstanding the likelihood that it won't come into force soon.
Yeah. Well, first, I would like to say that when it comes to candidates that are currently running for the Democratic nomination for president, all the elected officials, such as the senators and Representative Gabbard, all were co-sponsors of this bill. So that shows that this would be actually part of the platform for if the Democrats were to win. But also, I think this is a good chance for people to show, or a time to hold the representatives accountable, since there is no vote, and showing that this is important to us. I think that is like the big takeaway from the PRO Act and the future of it.
That was Margaret Poydock, Policy Associate with the Economic Policy Institute. Learn more about the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or PRO Act, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WZMO in Marion, Ohio, D Program Radio in Norwich, Norfolk, United Kingdom, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.